Hello, everybody. You are listening or watching Chatting with Candace. I'm your host, Candace Horback. And as always, before we hop into the episode, make sure you hit that like and subscribe button wherever you are listening or watching. That helps with the algorithm, helps grow the show, all that good stuff. And I greatly appreciate it. If you want to support the podcast, you can go to chattingwithcandace.com, click that little link that says Buy Me a Coffee, or Patreon. Patreon, get early access to episodes, sneak peek at future guests, and you get to talk to moi. This week, we have Melanie Notkin on. I'm so excited to have her on. We met on Twitter. She's doing really incredible work. She's the founder of Savvy Ante. It's a celebration of modern adulthood. She is the author of Savvy Ante, the ultimate guide for cool aunts, great aunts, godmothers, and all women who love kids. She is a very vocal person when it comes to childless people and how not everyone there intended on it. And hopefully this conversation encourages a little bit more compassion instead of dunking, which is what I see a lot of. Maybe it's my algorithm and I'm the one to blame. I don't know. We also start the conversation off with what is happening over in Israel and that whole movement going through college campuses. So we kind of get into current topics and then circle back to the very important work that she is doing around otherhood, motherhood, and culture and relationships. So without further ado, please help me welcome Melanie Notkin. Melanie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm so glad that I finally have you here. I feel like we've been online friends for a while now, so I'm so glad to like sit virtually with you and get to know you a little bit better.
Same for me. I'm very excited. I feel like I'm speaking to an old friend, even though this is like literally the first time we're hearing each other's voices, having a real conversation.
I think so too. Yeah, I think sometimes you just connect with somebody. And it's funny because when we first were scheduling this, I was super deep into like the birth gap and a lot of the what seems to be intentionally manipulated conversations around like parenthood, motherhood, people that are choosing to be childless versus people that are not choosing. And there's a lot there that I think most people aren't really aware of. And then obviously the world has kind of exploded since then. And we rescheduled because you were going to a rally. And obviously we were just talking about your newsfeed. So I'm sure it's going to go in 100 different directions because it's hard to kind of ignore. And first I wanted to say thank you for reposting my podcast that I guess this will be last week's now, but when this comes out, but I was saying how I was super nervous. And as you mentioned, there are people doing far braver things than making a video in the comfort of their home. So it's like the least that you can do is to tell the truth.
Absolutely. I mean, we're all on the front lines, whatever our front lines are. Thankfully, our front lines are right now in the safety of our own homes or wherever we are when we're tweeting. But obviously, people are in their lives are on the line, literally, you know, and these Israeli soldiers are 18, 19, 20 and older. I mean, they're people, you know, because the reservists went up. They're in their 30s, 40s, up to age 50. So it's sort of the least I think we can do is share the truth and not be afraid of it. And we must bear witness. We must bear witness. I mean, whenever I post something, I keep saying, but please don't look away.
I went to this retreat recently, and the way that they kind of described evil was like everyone thinks it's like this very dark thing. Sometimes it's very hard to see. It's hard to notice. I don't resonate with that, but that was kind of what he was saying. A lot of popular opinion is, and he's like, no, it's actually a blinding white light. It's so obvious, and it's your job to stare at it, to look at it, to not look away, because sometimes the things are so atrocious that is the reaction, is just don't look, don't pay attention, it'll go away, but it's your obligation as a good person to look.
Yeah, you have to look, and you have to share, and you have to try and get other people to look. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that's what the hostage posters are about, is so these people, many of them are still hostages, are not forgotten. that we keep seeing their faces again and again, especially the babies. I shouldn't even say especially. I mean, the moms who haven't seen their children, the children who haven't seen their moms, the men. We can't forget about the men. I mean, we elevate women in these situations, but of course, men, many of the fathers are left back as hostages while their children or their wives have been able to go back. Of course, there's still hundreds of hostages, not all Israelis, not all Jewish, a lot of foreign nationals. We don't even know where some of them are. Some of them are in people's homes. Like some Palestinians just took them as sort of as prizes or something. And Hamas claims they don't even know where all of them are. I mean, it's horrible. And that's why we have to keep showing it. We can't forget these people. They can't be lost from our sight and from our thinking and from our hope to get them back.
Yeah, it's interesting. In my preparation for this episode, I feel like a lot of things kind of intertwined and came full circle. So I was watching one of your older Tim Cast interviews, and you can see the comment section. It's like a live feed. And in there are like overtly anti-Semitic comments, you know, just like people put it, and this is from 2 years ago. It's just in the open, not ashamed to behave that way. And then you see what's happening on college campuses and just in public in general. Why do you think that seems to be one of the only tolerated forms of racism? Like, to me, that's really confusing, because it wasn't that long ago when everyone was kind of up in arms over the whole BLM movement. And what immediately I thought about was when a NASCAR driver had his garage open or something, and he had a tie, like a slip knot, in the garage, and immediately they thought it was, you know, a racist, like a node to like a noose or whatever. And it absolutely found out that was garbage. It got debunked right away. But like, that was how quick everyone was to say, like, that's unacceptable. You can't do that. And it wasn't even true. But you see blatant like Nazi signs on college campus buildings, and that's fine. Like, the students are getting kicked out. You have professors saying that they were exhilarated and energized and excited over this, like, and they're not getting let go. So why is this like the last form of acceptable racism?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I think perhaps because it's one of the oldest, if not the oldest. And of course, there's that whole paradigm of quote unquote intersectionality, where the powerful are at the top, or the supposed assumed powerful at the top, the less powerful are at the bottom, that white people are always at the top of this intersectional paradigm, as I called it, and those people of color at the bottom. And for whatever reason, much of the world has decided that Jews are white. We are not white. There are true that about half are from Eastern Europe, Ashkenazi Jews, but many, including half of me, are what we say are Mizrahi, or from the Middle East. Half of me is from Persia. My grandparents were born there. And of course, we have Ethiopian Jews and Sephardic Jews from Spain and other Hispanic lands. And yet for some reason, we're seen as white and therefore oppressors. And the tiny little speck of Israel in the Middle East, and if anybody looks at a map and sees all the other countries, Arabic countries around it, it's a tiny little speck. Somehow that is the great oppressor of the Middle East. And it's I think the once this idea of intersectionality it came out in the 70s, but it really became more popular in the last decade. And people are really learning about it, and they're deciding that Jews are white, and therefore Jews are oppressors, and therefore whatever happened to Jews, they had it coming to them, along with this language of oppression, of intersectionality comes oppression, and comes colonizing and occupying and all of these things. Israel's not a colonizer. Has never looked to colonize other lands. And in terms of occupation, you know, Israel left Gaza in 2005. In fact, literally dragged 9,000 Israelis from their homes in Gaza in 2005 until hostages were taken on October 7, 2023. There were no Jews living in Gaza. So what we've got is this lexicon of words that points a finger at Jews in this whole new sort of paradigm of anti-Semitism, which also then now leaps into anti-Zionism. And some have decided, well, it's different because it's against Israel. But of course, Israel's the Jewish state. And so anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, which doesn't mean you have to agree with the government, doesn't mean you have to agree with all the policies, just like you don't have to agree in any other country, including our own here in the U.S. But respect the fact that this is the Jewish state, and it has been, well, it's been for millennia, since literally biblical times, and in the modern era, officially since 1948.
Yeah, it's. I was at a party recently, and I don't know. I was just like, I was stunned by certain people's comments over everything that's happening in Israel and in Gaza. And one young lady said, "You can't be kidnapped if you're trespassing." And I just said, "Whoa!" Like, I immediately said, "Did you just?" And then I bit my tongue and I was like, that old Bible verse, which is don't cast pearls before swine, right? Like, just don't get into it with someone who's incapable of appreciating whatever it is that you're presenting and just recognizing that. And that's the situation I found myself in. And it, regardless of, again, like what politics you believe in, when you see like babies being taken, like how, like it doesn't matter. That's clearly the bad guy. Whoever is kidnapping a baby is clearly the bad guy, and there is no justification, or you don't need to go back 100 years or 50 years or 5 minutes ago to know that that's the bad guy. And this weird, like postmodernist place that we have kind of stumbled into as a society or what a Western society is just alarming, right? Like there is no bad guy. You need to know his backstory. You know, men and women are exactly the same, like all of this mumbo jumbo to seem like you're intelligent when really all you're doing is just creating a mess, and a mess where people just cannot thrive or succeed except for the people that are perpetuating these crazy ideas.
I agree. It's all part of the same cult of hate to use the term of wokeness. You know, mm-hmm. You have all of these words and all of these assumptions you're supposed to make. We have it certainly, you know, if you're a Democrat, you're supposed to believe certain things. If you're a Republican, you're supposed to, you know, agree with certain things. And of course, most of us agree with some things and not others. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to this, the assumption is, well, okay, well, if Israel is filled with Jews and Jews are white, and again, Jews are not white, then whatever they do, they must be the ones who are guilty and or deserving of whatever it is that's coming to them. And it's as if they can ignore any facts, any true history. And if one brings up the facts and true history, they decide that that just couldn't be true because it's coming from the mouths of the Jews and the Jews are the oppressors. So you just keep going in circles. And it's so again, all we can do is just keep trying to share the truth and do what good people do, which is, you mentioned I went to a rally. So I did. I went to Washington, D.C. for the March for Israel rally. I don't know if it was a rally, but it was 300,000 of us. And not only from the U.S., I saw a lot of Canadians there. People flew in from all over the place to support. And people keep remarking, even last night, somebody I met had been there. We kept saying, wow, look at us. We're so proud of us because there was no litter. There was no violence. There's no screaming. There was no, it wasn't joy because we were there thinking about all the hostages, many of whom hadn't yet been released. And of course, many of them are still hostages of the soldiers who were on the front lines. And of course, the people who were the 1,200 people who were murdered, several they don't even know. They haven't even been able to identify their DNA, sadly, tragically. And yet, you know, here we were united. And there was this great feeling of peace having each other, even if we were just strangers, many of us to each other, most of us to each other. So I've just never been more proud to be a Jew than I was right there in that moment. And I think we just have to keep showing, I'm saying we, Jews and allies, as many like to say, that we're better than destroying, than being violent, than harassing. You know, you talked about what's going on in the schools. I mean, I have a first degree relationship with a young woman who was in that Cooper Union library.
Wow.
And, you know, this stuff is very personal. Everybody seems to now know somebody, whether here in the U.S. or in Canada, where I'm from Montreal, the anti-Semitism there is becoming very violent. My high school building was shot up a couple of weeks ago. Thank God it was at night and nobody was there. Nobody got hurt. It's becoming very threatening. And even the streets of New York City, where I live, two women were arrested for sort of pulling another woman, Jewish woman, to the ground because she asked why they were taking down the hostage posters. It is scary. I will say it is scary. Are we going to sort of relent and just hide? No, of course not. In fact, if anything, it is the thing that rallies 300,000 people to get together in the middle of the week. It is the type of thing that makes us keep hanging up those hostage photos, to keep tweeting about it, to have, you know, a half hour podcast just saying, what are you talking about? Like you did last week, Candace. So it's the time to be stronger than ever.
And where do you find that bravery? Because I was going to ask if you were scared and you said you're not. And you just said we're not going to hide. And where do you find that courage? Because the threat is real. You see the videos. They're endless online. I ask because – so I didn't even – I found out later on in my life that I was Jewish. And the whole way – I guess the whole reason I didn't know. So my grandfather had survived one of the camps and had to, like, after he was let out, save up money and immigrate to the United States. And then he just kind of hid that part of himself, like shut it down. My mom knew. She went to Hebrew school and all of that. And for similar reasons, just like didn't really broadcast it. Mm-hmm. And then I find out way later and it's like, well, I get it. He went through something horrific and as evil as it gets. So I understand trying to preserve that, right? And having firsthand experience of how violent it can get. And then, I don't know, how do you find the courage to say not again, never again? How do you find the courage to, like, you see Noah Tishby, I've been following all of her stuff, and she's just decked out in Stars of David everywhere. And I'm like, that brave, like anyone that says women aren't brave, like watch some of these Jewish women. Yep. Like that's bravery. It might look different, right? Like they're not men, so they're not going to go out there with swords or start a fight, but that's brave.
Yeah. Well, I just to that point, I mean, there, my, I was, mentioned that what half of me is Persian. My mother's family, for a few generations, were in a city in Persia in Iran called Mashhad. And at first they were there and everybody was very friendly to them. They had a decent life there as Jews, but soon after they were forced to convert to Islam upon pain of death. And so for two or three generations, they had to pretend that they were Muslims and hide their Judaism. And these were very Orthodox Jews. And yet they persevered and eventually moved to London, England, or New York, and kept their Judaism with them. And then on my father's side, my father's father, when he was 4 years old, emigrated to Canada. His family were, you know, in awful pogroms in the Ukraine. It's because they survived that I have to be fearless. And I say that, you know, in a way with, you know, there, I know what two friends of mine have nephews who were soldiers and were killed in the war since October 7th. What I'm doing is hardly anywhere near as brave. It's sort of the least I can do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're all soldiers now in a way. So that's what you got to do. We are at war and Israel's the Jewish state. And, you know, I have the luxury of being able to go visit whenever I want. And the people there, the 9 million or so Jews there, they're keeping it safe for me. They're guarding it. They're guarding it for me. It's the least I can do is to be brave for them.
So I was reading one of your recent articles and you were talking about these, let me see if I wrote it down. It's one of those dinners, the thought criminals dinners. So that probably sounds impossible to a lot of people. You were saying that there are basically every political affiliation and you guys get together and you wrestle with ideas and then you'll go and enjoy dessert. And it sounds like no one's taking things personal. How do we get back to a place where we can have civil discourse and have difficult conversations around tough topics and it not be so polarizing and it not be so alienating?
Well, talk about being fearless, right?
Yeah.
Because today, you know, people get canceled for saying something, and canceled, I don't mean necessarily fired from a job or something like that, but even like canceled from their group of friends. Mm-hmm. Becoming part of the out group instead of the in group. Yeah, I wrote this piece about these secret underground heterodox groups, and I'm a part of a couple of them and actually introduced two of them last January. And they wondered, Melanie, how did we not know about each other? And I'm like, because they're secret. I keep secret. So, you know, it started just with friends who were like-minded on some issues. So look, friends who, you know, one group that were like-minded on Israel. So when Gaza was shooting rockets at Israel, back in, I think it was 2015, somebody started a group because on regular Facebook, it was just too many comments that were, you know, of people who said, well, you know, Israel should just sort of lay back and take it and not fight back or something. And then with another group, it was, you know, a few people who, you know, were in media or similar occupations, and they, you know, found themselves not being able to say what they want or talk about what they want, et cetera. And so two people, sort of leaders of these things, formed these groups and began to invite more and more people who were also expressing themselves publicly in more heterodox ways. And the idea, and Pamela Paresky, who I can say publicly because she outed herself in the New Yorker in an article that came out before mine, how, you know, the idea is that you have to be willing to break bread with somebody you don't agree with. And I agree. I think that that is what is so important. I do draw the line. I don't think you have to break bread with people who right at this moment are Hamas supporters, terrorist supporters. I don't think you need to give them breath right now, which isn't to say I don't believe in free speech, et cetera. I don't need to put myself through that. But that aside, terrorism aside, I think that it's important that we start to share our thoughts. And if anything, because more and more so, we're all finding each other. And the more we talk about the things that we think, you know, for instance, you know, not agreeing that trans women should be on swim teams with biological women. Already I'm saying something that can get me canceled, right? But I have to be brave enough to say it. You know, when people start to talk about that stuff, how they really feel, well, that's how things change or maybe don't change in the way that, because we don't want them to change. And I think that, you know, we all know those people. And so I hope, like, your listeners, if, because they're probably heterodox thinkers, you know, if they are listening to you and I know a lot of your guests are heterodox thinkers. You had the amazing God Saad on and, you know, and others who are, you know, brave. And I think that people need to just get a couple of people together, and then maybe they invite a couple of people, and you just start having these dinners or drinks or what have you, and have these conversations. I think they're more important because we really are this sort of silent majority of people who just don't want to take the nonsense anymore.
Did you see that new trailer for, it's a movie coming out on Daily Wire, and it's got a bunch of comedians in it. I think it's called, I just saved it on my Twitter. It's hilarious. The movie is called Lady Ballers. So I'll have the editors put a clip in so people can see it. But it's basically these older, mediocre sports dads who kind of are, quote, washed up, or, you know, they've already
reached their peak.
Capped. But yeah, they've already peaked. And then they realize through one of the 8-year-old daughters that you could be considered a woman just by saying you're a woman. So now it's all of these grown men competing with these young girls at various sports and just crushing them. And it just shows how ridiculous it all is. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about comedy, is it can kind of bring things right in front of you and you can't deny it. You can't deny the absurdity of all of it.
Well, you know what? I think that we haven't had that because comedians haven't been able to be funny, right? So it takes, unfortunately, the Daily Wire to come out with this type of movie. And, you know, it's been a while since, I mean, it's sad. I don't watch the late night shows, or many sitcoms just aren't that funny because you just can't laugh at life anymore. Mm-hmm. And everything has to be this sort of lesson in whatever is the latest, hottest, politically correct thing. So, I love it. I encourage it. And I'm glad that, I'm hoping that more mainstream, I just need it to creep back into the mainstream media and creative outlets.
So do you think a lot of what's happening with like something like the Leah Thomas situation, right?
Yeah.
Is that men and young boys not having opportunity to find purpose and to have like a valid struggle where they can have that feeling of achievement? Right. Like they don't feel like they have a place. Now they're encroaching on women's spaces. Like what is, because you don't see the inverse of it. Like you don't see trans women that are trying to like bulldoze their way into biological males spaces. It's not happening.
Right.
You do see trans women often, you know, that's what you see in the news, that are going into women's locker rooms, going into women's sports, going into women's safe spaces, trying to go into women's prisons. Like it's weird. And I've had Buck Angel on the show, and he's like a trans man. And he's like, please don't put me in the male prisons. If I ever get in jail, like I will die. I will die in there.
Right.
So it's acknowledging that, you know, biological sex is real and there is a difference. But for some reason, we're letting our young girls just get beat up by biological males.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's And of course, not just beat up, but losing out on competition, losing out on scholarships, losing out on the experiences they worked hard for, or losing out on their privacy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there are a number of things going on here. I think that in a way, actually, girls have been encroaching on boys' territory. For instance, all of a sudden, the Boy Scouts couldn't be Boy Scouts. They had to also now have girls. I think, you know, there's girls in STEM, there's no boys in STEM. To your point, I think that boys are being left behind. We don't champion boys the way we champion girls. Even now, you know, if you're in college and you want to get an internship, you may see a flyer around campus and it says, you know, people BIPOC, people of color and women are encouraged to apply, which means guys don't bother. It could be that some of them are just trying to say, you know what, I can't make it as a man, I'll make it as a woman. It could be. In fact, wasn't it like a month ago, wasn't there some competition for women and a bunch of guys came and said, well, we're women today. a student competition. I forget what it was. And, you know, there are also issues of, well, let's say there is a small percentage of these trans girls and women who do have severe gender dysphoria. Okay. But then there are those with autogynephilia, which I don't know if you've talked about in your podcast.
Briefly, ages ago.
They get, you know, basically turned on by people thinking they're a woman. I'm not accusing Leah Thomas or anybody else of that. I don't know their psychology. But, you know, here's the difference, I think. Someone with severe gender dysphoria where they really truly believe they are in the wrong sex physically, they don't want you to see their body parts, because to them it really is the, you know, if you think you're a man, nobody should see your breasts because you're a man. If you truly believe you're a woman, you wouldn't want anybody to see your penis. You know, yeah. If I woke up one day with a penis, I would hide it. I wouldn't want anybody to see it as a woman. And those who lean into the autogynephilia, well, that's kind of the turn on, right? I want you to think I'm a woman, but also know I'm a man. So who knows if that's what's going on in some locker rooms? It could be. I don't know. And I'm not alleging it is to anybody specifically, but it could be. So why are these guys doing it? I think to your point, I think some of them are trying to say, well, if you're going to take my space, I'll take yours. Some of them are whether or not that's justified, I'm not saying it's justified at all. Some of them have true gender dysphoria, and some of them are enjoying it. And sadly, I think that's the majority. I could be wrong, mm-hmm. but that's what I think.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that it's almost an excuse to exercise misogyny. That's what I see. It's sure. almost like the most misogynistic thing is to just say you as a woman are invalid and your space is invalid and your sense of safety is invalid. What matters is my personal identity, and that's it. And to me, again, I agree. Like, if someone has actual gender dysphoria, I don't see them being like a violent person and, you know, trying to get all of the attention on themselves, because they're already going through a lot, right? Like, think of anyone that has any kind of mental disorder or mental illness or whatever. Like, you're going through a lot. The last thing you want is to add to that. So I think it's probably something else.
Yeah. I mean, somebody who's anorexic, they think mm-hmm. that they are very overweight. Not everybody, but wear big sweatshirts and, you know, kind of cover themselves up, even if they're, you know, tragically very underweight. They don't want you to see their body because they see their body differently. So sort of if you think about that, it's a body dysmorphia. So, yeah. But my heart goes out to anybody and everybody who's suffering from that.
For sure.
Because it's tragic. And, you know, I think that it's strange that we don't have moral clarity on this, that somehow we've lost moral clarity on this, on what it's doing and how it's affecting girls and women. And I also stress that we need moral clarity on what we're doing to boys and young men. We tend not to see them. And not to count, you know, when we talk about, you know, gender wage gap, and not think about, well, you know, 96, I think, percent of people who die on the job are men. You know, men have much more dangerous jobs. There are a lot of reasons for this quote unquote gap, which is closing, thankfully. But, you know, I don't know why, but we as a society tend to sort of, you know, like throw men's issues under the rug as if we don't need to see them. And I think that's a mistake. I think that we all need to try both sexes, need to try harder to see each other and how we are not necessarily understanding each other and where we're coming from, and be supportive. It would be nice if there were more men, I know there are some, who stick up for women in this sort of era of of trans people taking women's places, that would be great. And I hope I see more of that.
I was reading this book. I want to say it was in The Boy Crisis. And I don't know if you've read that. It's an incredible, incredible book. I highly recommend it to everybody. You don't have to have a son to, or a husband to read it. It impacts all levels of society. And they kind of break that down. But he, I believe, was suggesting that one of the reasons that we discard men and boys so easily was back in the day, like, they were the warriors. They were the ones protecting the villages. They had the more dangerous jobs, so their lives were expendable. And then that has kind of been baked into us subconsciously to keep perpetuating that, the devaluation of the masculine and of men. Yes. And now, thankfully, you know, we have modernity and we don't necessarily need men to just self-sacrifice all of the time. So it's like we need to kind of fight some of our biology and say our son's feelings are just as valid as our daughter's feelings. Our boy's feelings are just as valid. Their ability to thrive in education is just as important. When both sexes are doing well, society does well. It doesn't make sense to take someone out by the knees so you can prop someone else up. Right? You don't have to do that. You can try to create systems and programs to balance that out so that all young people have the opportunity to do their best. And what seems to have happened is in this correction to try to give space for women and young girls is that we just said, oh, well, we're just going to take it from boys instead of just providing additional resources.
Yes, I agree. And of course, there are, you know, men who are in the service here in the U.S., mm-hmm. obviously in Israel and other Western societies where we, and women too. And in Israel, you know, it's half women. The women are conscripted as well. In fact, there was a great story of like four young women that were like 19, 20 years old. And, you know, they heard about what was going on October 7th that morning. They were already somewhere. And they jumped in the tanks that they hadn't even been trained on. And they ended up, you know, thankfully saving a whole kibbutz, a whole community.
Wow.
Because of this tank work that they did. I mean, it was extraordinary. You know, women do, and it was interesting because they said that this proves that women can drive tanks. Women can do this. Now, you know, however, there's a reason why, you know, women, when they are conscripted into the army, they only spend 2 years and the men spend 3 years because women have fertility, which is mm-hmm. not as long as men's fertility. And so Israel's quite supportive of seeing that and understanding that as well. So, you know, we have to sort of look at everything and how, yeah, women can do a lot more than we knew we could do 50 years ago or even 20 years ago. But that doesn't mean that we don't have to be sensitive to the fact that women aren't men. And that women have their, you know, limits on fertility and they need to be out there and dating and all of that. So again, we just need to understand each other and all the limits of our biology and of our, and the wonderful differences in our sexes.
I just recently had a guest on. I never published the episode because it went so poorly.
Oh, no.
And it went so poorly. And I was bringing up the point of biology from a woman's standpoint and the fact that, no, marriage is not something that you should look at like a trophy that you have to like go get, right? Like there's something more magical to finding the right person and making a family. However, right, this and biology is real. So knowing that, you know, you start to decline heavily into your early 30s, right, as far as your success rate of a healthy egg turning into a baby goes, make decisions based off of what you want. So if you want a family and if you want a husband, I'm not saying to do nothing except like put yourself out there and hopefully someone picks you. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I'm saying if you're going to go after the high-powered career that's going to demand 90 hours out of you, you are making a choice there and just be aware of the choice. Mm-hmm. And she was like, and then this kind of ties back into my exhaustion with the spiritual community was, Well, if you just look at it from abundance, you can have a baby anytime. You can find your partner at any time. And I was like, so you're telling me that at 60 years old, with no intervention, you're going to have a baby. Biologically, you're going to have a baby. You know what I mean? And it was just like so much woo. And I love woo. Don't get me wrong. Like, I love a little bit of magic, but also keep your feet on the ground.
Yeah.
And I feel like you're doing such a disservice to young women. Mm-hmm. When you're telling them that you don't have to face these the reality. And I had Stephen Shaw on, and he's like, at least half of the women who can no longer have children didn't plan for that, right? Like, they wanted families.
It's actually about 80% of women.
Whoa. Who
want children, expected children. I listened to that episode, and Stephen's a good friend. And I love him.
He's great.
Yes, he's great. His work on Birth Gap is fantastic. I wrote my second book, Otherhood, yellow book behind me, is a reported memoir on what happened with Generation X and now older millennials who expected that we would have the education and the career opportunities our mothers didn't have the access to. I mean, when, you know, my mother, that generation, you know, we're thinking of getting a job. It would be, you know, you could be a secretary, a teacher, a nurse, or a nun. So if you were Jewish, you only had three choices. And maybe a seamstress. And, you know, we, you know, my generation, you know, girls of the 70s and 80s, we had much more choice. And with that, you know, came guys who were dating these women. Who, by the way, were not prioritizing career. I think that's a bit of a fallacy in that not all women are looking for these high-powered careers. They want to make a living. They want to earn a living because they're not living at home at 35. They have their own homes. In fact, single women are more likely to own real estate than men. But at the same time, you know, I remember I moved to New York from Montreal when I was like 23 or 24, and I was literally asking about like maternity benefits in my job interview, because I was totally coming to New York to meet a great Jewish guy and get married. Well, 30 years later, still looking. You know, and that was my priority. Marriage was my priority. I worked in nonprofit, partly because that was my visa to work in the US. But also because I expected I'd get married, and I wanted to be able to earn a living. I didn't want to, depend on my husband so that if, God forbid, something happened to him or we divorced or what have you, that I wouldn't have a way to earn a living. But, you know, no, marriage, having children was without a question my priority. So it doesn't always happen. But in general, most women I know and talk about in my book, in Otherhood, who really wanted children would always prioritize. You know, I remember somebody would say, well, you know, she was 35 at the time. Well, you know, I'm a career woman. I said, well, there are no career men. What makes you a career woman? You didn't choose, did you choose, you know, your job to pay rent over getting married, having children? She said, no, of course not. I said, well, have you ever, you know, said you wouldn't go on a date with a guy you really liked because you had a business meeting? You had to get on Zoom? No, of course not. So why do you say that? You know, women, we talk about these sort of language and lexicon. Women have sort of the script that women have is that we're career women. And of course, there are career women. There's no question that there are women who prioritize career and never wanted children or even prioritize career and wanted children. Mm-hmm. But most women just want to have a, you know, live life to their potential, do as best that they can, and get married and have children. And like I said, there are no career men. Nobody says to a man, oh, you're 35 and single. Well, you're married to your career, like they do to a woman. Sometimes she just needs to earn a living. So I push back on that, on the career woman thing. You know, back in, you know, in the Mad Men era, you know, Peggy Olson was a career woman. No doubt about it. There were career women because they were outliers. Today, even married mothers work. So most women want children, and the some of the problems, I know Stephen brought some up, and I urge everybody to listen to that episode of the podcast because it was great. Other issues are this sort of disconnect with the guys. Women, no doubt, have become more masculine because mm-hmm. we've become more independent. And men have become more feminine because women, you know, when it comes to dating, for instance, a guy will, you know, ask a woman out, let's say, and then sit back. And she's busy planning the date and, you know, organizing everything and then taking out her purse to pay. And they don't give space to a man to be a man. And a lot of men say, well, you know, I want to make sure she's happy. So let her choose everything. Let her. I'm finding, because of all the interviews I've done, that actually most women want a traditional guy, you know, chivalrous guy, who's going to plan the date. And I think that some men just don't know that. And they're almost afraid to be accused of, you know, being sort of taking over or sort of being patriarchal or whatever it is, right? And mm-hmm. most women kind of just want a guy's pretty chivalrous, and they feel like they're being taken care of just even for that night. And we're not, and many of us are just not insisting that guys do that, or not giving them the space to do it, to sort of taking over. So that's just one example, but I think that we're in a place where we're kind of not, again, the theme of this podcast, we're not seeing each other and we're not listening to each other and we're assuming things about each other. And it's leaving a lot of women single, despite their deepest yearnings. I mean, most women I know who've been single in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, it's not easy. It can be really, especially if you want children, which most women do. You can be in this, and Stephen mentioned it, you can be in this, and I've written about it plenty, this level of, it's dark, it's depressing, because the thing you want most is out of your control. So I'd be hesitant to always point at the career. I think women can date and pay the rent. And I write about it. I've known women who certainly have said, you know, they were on the partner track in the law firm and they were, you know, mid 30s or even just 32. And they've said, you know what? I can't do it. Dating is my priority. And they've, you know, moved into HR, moved into marketing. And one girl quipped, she's like, yeah, now I don't have the, I'm 38, don't have the guy or the walk-in closet that I could have paid for if I stayed on it. But, you know, they make their choices and they prioritize. Many women do that. It's very rare that it's their career that has stopped them from having what they want most. You know, if you meet a couple and, you know, one lives in one state, the other lives in another state, more often than not, the woman moves where the guy is. Like, women will do somersaults just to be with the guy she loves and get married and have a family. There's very few things that will stop a woman getting what she wants, except the things she can't control, which is what you started this podcast with, which was the magic of love, finding love. And I don't mean that in a sort of in a fairy tale way. Women don't want a prince. I always say, you know, what would I do with the horse? I don't want a man in tights. You know, we're not waiting for farming. We're just waiting for love. And sometimes it takes longer. I mean, I know my dad has been married. He's 90 years old. He's been married, I think, about 30 years to my stepmom. My mom passed away many years ago. And he still calls her his bride. They sit on the couch. We're on FaceTime. Then he goes to hold her hand. She takes amazing care of him, and he takes care of her. You know, we all want that kind of love. And sometimes we have to wait longer. And sometimes that means, sadly, not having the children we deeply wanted. But again, most women choose love. And I hear you on your podcast, and I believe you have love. and you have family, you have kids, and you have this great podcast and gorgeous hair.
Thanks.
So, I mean, like, and what I certainly appreciate is that you talk to somebody like me and you talk to Stephen Shaw about, you know, what about those women who don't have everything that they want? And so I deeply appreciate your wanting to understand. And again, so it's woman to woman, but you also want to see how this other group of women live. So thank you.
Oh my gosh, of course. I think one of my biggest motivators with this, it's you see women who found themselves childless, and that is just going to be their life. And then you'll see the conservative right kind of dunk on them, or the red pill community dunk on them. And it's like, that is such a loss. So I was told I was infertile basically my whole young adulthood. I had endometriosis, PCOS, mm-hmm. Graves' disease. So it's like a triple whammy of infertility. I did a bunch of just more Eastern practices, and thank God it worked. In my mind, that is kind of what led me to being able to be a mother. But I had to grieve the idea of being a mom when I was younger, because I was told by multiple professionals it wasn't going to happen. So if you have the idea of you want a family that is part of your future, and then you are come to the realization that you are not going to have that, it's devastating. It's absolutely devastating. So the last thing anyone needs to be doing is dunking on that person. That makes no sense to me at all. And it's the side that's supposed to be, you know, leading with compassion, and I don't see very much of it there. Mm-hmm. And then also additionally, you have like the quote red pill based community that's now telling young men not to get married and not to have kids. And that is what an alpha man does. You know, he has a harem, and that is the most meaningless way to live, in my opinion. Like, you want to build a life with somebody. You get purpose from your relationships, whether they are, you know, your friendships, platonic or romantic, or your kids. Like, we exist within relationship to what is around us. So to say that you can live this very selfish life and just rack up all of the cars, money, and girls, and then you're going to be happy is so misleading. So I just think that there needs to be more of a nuanced conversation around, like, well, what is fulfilling? What's happening to this large amount of people that aren't having kids? Like, unintentionally, right? So that if you're someone who's maybe in your early 20s, that you can learn from other people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe make different choices or stop dating the wrong person. I see that a lot too. And I think we talked about it on Steven's episode, because there was this one poor woman. I think she was Thai, and she was married to a white man, and he's out drinking at the bars all day, smoking. She's at home cleaning, cooking. She wants a family, but he's not ready yet. And he's really a good guy. And she's like really trying to convince herself and the audience that he's a good person. Obviously he's not. And her, you know, fertile years were just thrown away for what is clearly a wrong match.
Yeah.
And it's just understanding your worth. And again, if you know what you want, then just make better choices. And I know that some of it is beyond that, but control what you can. So if you're with someone who doesn't want to get married, who doesn't want kids, and you want the opposite, well then, you know, just acknowledge that you're not a match and move on, because time is so precious and valuable and fleeting.
No question. There's a chapter in my book called Izzy Got Robbed, and it's like, you know, she gorgeous woman, and would date, you know, these A+ guys, Wall Street type guys, and each one would sort of lead her on and never be serious. And then she said, okay, well, I'm going to be with this teacher. And this guy, you know, so he was earning less than her and very mild, you know, just kind of. And she kept saying, okay, well, let's get engaged. You know, she wanted to get engaged. She was in her mid-30s and late-30s and getting toward. Then she found out he was having an affair with another teacher. He robbed her of her last years of fertility. How does somebody love somebody? They were living together, you know? So for her, obviously it was a shock. So again, you know, sometimes it's out of their control. And I've heard more stories than that than I'd like to know about. On the other hand, I 100% agree with you that young women, you know, I hope so many young women, if you, young women and men, if you did not listen to the Stephen J. Shaw podcast with Candace, please listen to it. And listen to me. Yes, we choose love. But if you're 38 and you're dating a guy, you don't know, you know, if he's sort of on the edge, you're not sure, and you know, you're sort of at the end of your fertility, you choose love, that's one thing. But if you're 25, you'll have some heartbreak, but it won't be the heartbreak of, please God, of not having children. Go find the love that wants children and make that your priority if that's what you want. And I know you talked about egg freezing, et cetera, and it's true. Most eggs frozen don't end up in a live birth. And part of that is, well, because women, it's, you know, meet somebody and they get married and they use their eggs, they get pregnant the natural way. Sometimes it just doesn't take. And that's very, very sad. I know single women who've tried at the end of their fertility around, you know, 40 to do it and it doesn't work. Don't rely on your eggs. Freeze your eggs if you can afford it, but don't rely on them. If getting married and having children is your priority, please make sure it's your priority. And to your point earlier, again, at the top of the conversation, you know, it doesn't mean you're standing on a street corner saying I'm single, although, hey, you never know. But make it a priority. Don't go out with the guys who just want to fool around. If he's not taking you on dates, he's not serious. Put yourself first and what you need first. I think that's the best gift you can give to yourself, and you will also appreciate yourself and your own self-worth and your value.
Yeah, I agree. It obviously, it's not cool for a guy to do that to a woman, right? To drag her along knowing that he doesn't want kids and he's just keeping her there out of convenience. But also, I think a huge factor that not enough people highlight is personal accountability on the woman's side too, right? It's recognizing the signs, because he's telling you even if he's not telling you. And I know so many women that ignore it, and then from the outside looking in, it is just black and white. It is so clear what's happening, what the guy's intentions are, what he actually wants out of the relationship, but they're holding on for hope. But it's they are who they are. They want who they want, and if he hasn't changed yet, he's not going to, right? So it just cut your losses and kind of move on. And I think I see a lot of that too when it comes to more of like the progressive side of the conversation, is like no accountability on the woman's part. And again, going back to the podcast that never aired, the word patriarchy was used like 17 times. And I should have asked, like, what is the patriarchy? Like, can you explain to me so I know when I see it to go the other way? Like, what is the patriarchy? And one of the questions, and it goes back to women not holding other women accountable, was she was kind of blaming everything on the patriarchy or men. Right. So near the end of the conversation, I said, okay, well, what about this? What about the women that are the cruelest to other women? Because Jordan Peterson has this really good quote / thought exercises that we say men are violent because we can see it. They punch, they kick, they fight, they brawl. So we're like, men are violent. But women might even be more violent. They just use a different tactic. And it's reputation damage. It's gossip. It's drama. It's more just like social damnation, right?
Yeah.
So when you have a woman who's like, especially when it comes to sexuality, you have a woman, let's say she's more promiscuous, the people that are going to critique her the most are actually other women. And that's more because of competition. So what's that about? Like, it's obviously not men. So why are some women so violent and cruel to other women? And she paused, and her response was,
the patriarchy.
Yes.
You can't do that. No. And women, this whole, like, you know, women's spaces and women, before COVID, we, you know, because there was WeWork and all of those, you know, and I worked in a couple, not WeWork, but other similar spaces. And then they started this thing called The Wing. I don't know how far it got across the country. It was in New York, and it was for women only. In fact, like, you couldn't even have a male visitor, like, for a meeting there, what have you. And I'm like, you know, feminism was about getting a seat at the table with men. not about getting a seat at a table only with women in a completely different building. I don't know why women don't appreciate the value of men. Men are, and also because men aren't going to stab you in the back, aren't going to be talking about you behind your back, aren't going to, you know, that whole inner woman competition, intersectional competition, which is totally evolutionary, right? Like older women see younger, beautiful, smart women, and they're not going to want them to compete with them. And this is, again, millennia and millennia old. I don't know why women feel that they need to cut men out of their lives professionally. You know, one of the sad outcomes, Me Too did a lot of good work, of course. Unless you're Jewish and Israeli, then rape is okay, it seems. But that's all going back to the other story, sadly. But one thing it did was that it made men at work not want to mentor women, not going to want to take a younger, more junior woman on a business trip or anything like that, should they be potentially accused of something that they didn't do. And so women are missing out on a lot of things. Women have to need to appreciate men for all the good that men do, and men do a lot of good. Obviously, there are terrible, horrible people of both sexes. But this whole like women for women only thing, I don't get it. And why is it wonderful, empowering, and great, and champion these, you know, women's group, women professionals, young women, women entrepreneurs? But a minute men's group starts, oh, it's like, you know, a neo-Nazi. What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Men need each other. And in fact, men who have friendships with other men, or in general, but specifically other men, as they age, actually live longer, healthier lives. And men can get very lonely. And many men are lonely. We're seeing, you know, unfortunately now, so many drug overdoses, suicides of men in America, much more so than women. I think, again, going back to the theme, seems to be the theme of this podcast, we need to see each other and understand each other and the value of our sexes. This whole believe all women thing, I don't believe it.
No, it's like, you've never met a woman that's told a lie? That's outlandish. Like, what are you talking about? What game are we playing?
And sadly, you know, for whatever reason, poor men are, you know, on the other side. I mean, I've heard cases of this, you know, like people in my life where, you know, guys in college and accused of something he didn't do, or rather not accused, like basically the woman is saying they had sex. The woman is saying, you know, it was rape. It wasn't rape. But there goes his life because she regrets it. So, you know, this is, I don't know why we can't love the other sex, appreciate the other sex, unless ironically the other sex wasn't biologically that sex, but has transitioned to that sex, then it's no holds bar. So I don't know. We just got it. I love men. I champion men. I appreciate men. Men have done such wonderful things for me in my life, as have women. I hope, again, we can begin to see the value in each other.
I agree. I think that's the only way. And then you have to ask yourself, it's who benefits from all of this division, whether it's between the sexes, between political ideology, between race, whatever, right? They want you so busy fighting that you don't see other encroachments that are happening. And I think when it comes to men and women, if you can divide the household, well, now, you know, you have the kids, right? Yeah. Big daddy government has the kids, and you get to teach them to continue to hate each other, and on we go. And It's sad too, because you would think that by having a son, for example, it would wake you up to how ridiculous some of these ideologies are. But you will see, like, one of the I always mess up her name, she's a supermodel, Emma Ratajkowski, I think. So she has a son, I believe, and she is like one of those very traditional, I hate men, I'm a feminist. Julie Fox has a son, and she's did a lie detector test that went viral. And the guy asking the questions was asking, do you hate men? And she's like, no, I don't hate men. And he says, well, that was a lie. And she goes, ah. And she's like gasping, but it's funny. I'm like, well, your little boy's going to be a man and he's going to see this. And that's really embarrassing. And that's really sad because he deserves to be loved. And he deserves for you to want the best for him, just as your daughter would if you had one of those. And I don't know. It's like these mental gymnastics that you can do where you say you hate men, but then you're raising one. It doesn't make sense to me at all. And it just breaks my heart.
It doesn't make you more of a woman to hate men. And I don't know why or how that became a thing. I don't know. There's a lot in the culture of Gen Z about, you know, that it's a celebration to break up with a guy.
Divorce parties. Have you seen those?
But even breaking up with a boyfriend. I don't need him. We had some of that in the 70s where, you know, I can, you know, bring home the bacon, fry it up in a pan. There was this old soap commercial. But somehow it's resurrected itself into this kind of really, I'm forgetting. What's the word? The opposite of misogyny for a woman. I'm forgetting the word. The female version of misogyny.
I didn't know. Oh, emasculation?
No, yeah, that, but it's a different word. It's mal something. Anyway, I'm sure somebody will put it in the comments. Women, it somehow became this, like, again, this idea back to that theme of just, you know, just throw men under the bus. Like, who cares about men? I don't understand where it's coming from. And to your point, like, I hate to think that there's this, you know, powerful something or other that is driving men and women apart. And I do think that men and women are being driven apart. And all that's left are sad women and sad men or lonely people. And I hoped that COVID would have changed some of that, that people would see how hard it is to be alone. And yet somehow it's stronger than ever. And it's as if, you know, speaking of believing all women, I don't believe it when women say that they don't want to, you know, they don't want to be in love. They don't need a man. I mean, straight women, obviously. I don't believe it. Obviously, there will be some women like that. Maybe I know a couple, but in general, know of them. I don't know them personally. But in general, I mean, it's okay to need somebody. It's okay to want somebody. It doesn't make you less powerful. It doesn't mean you can't take care of yourself. But to have the opportunity to take care of somebody else, to have the opportunity to know you can just let go and have somebody take care of you. I mean, I'm sure you have with your husband. There are days where he's just like, I just too stressed. I can't deal. Or same with you. And you balance each other out. I mean, that's what relationships are for. And they can be, you know, they don't have to be heterodox relationships. People of the same sex can have those dynamics as well. Mm-hmm. But we just, in general, we need each other. And I don't know, like, I love being in love. I love just going on a date, even if I know, you know, it's not going to be something. I just love, you know, just being out with somebody and discovering somebody and laughing and learning about somebody, probably learning about myself. I hope we can bring love back. Let's bring love back, Candace, you and I.
I hope so. I really do. That's an amazing note to end on. Yeah, you could choose anything. So just choose love. It's not bad. It's not bad. It's great over here. I promise.
It's great. I've been in love. I've been in love for like a day. I've been in love. You know, the one thing that you never have to lose hope on, you can lose hope on having children, but you never have to lose hope about love. There's a line in my book, Otherhood, talking about my dad, his then 80th birthday, and I went to visit him and all these beautiful couples at the party, all gorgeous, you know, all in their 70s and 80s. And it starts with, you know, sometimes the first snow falls late in winter. Sometimes love comes later, but it's worth the wait.
That's so beautiful. Before we wrap up, can you tell everyone where they can follow you, how they can support you, any projects you're working on, all that good stuff?
Thank you very much. And thank you for this. I love talking to you.
You too.
Thank you. So, so Savvy Auntie, SavvyAuntie on all the socials, except TikTok, because I ain't got time for that. And Otherhood is my book. Men, especially women, but men will love it too. I'm very proud of it. It was actually optioned for television, although never happened, but it's that good. And on Twitter, I'm talking a lot about Israel, but everywhere else, talking about aunthood. So join me there and save the date. The fourth Sunday in July is the, I think, 16th annual Aunties Day, where you can love all these, celebrate all the other mothers in your child's life, or if you're an aunt, celebrate yourself. So thank you very much. And I hope we continue the conversation on social. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, you too. And thank you again so much.
My pleasure.
And that's all for this week's episode. Before you go, please leave that 5-star review. It helps me out immensely. I really appreciate it. And if it's been a while since you've done it, you can do it more than once. Hit that little button for me, please, before you go. And I will link all of our guest resources below. If you enjoyed the conversation, share on social, share with a friend or two. That's the best way to grow a show, is word of mouth. And I will see you next episode. Bye, everybody.